Hi there, and welcome to the Growing Opportunities podcast series. I am Michelle Roberge.
And I am Megan Darcy.
We are the agriculture coordinators for the regional district of Bulkley Chaco.
We are small-scale farmers with a keen interest in agriculture, and we're excited to be using this format to communicate information about regional agriculture to the broader community. This podcast series will touch on different agriculture topics important to new farmers and producers wanting to diversify their farm operations.
If you have questions about these podcasts or anything agriculture in the regional district, please go to rdbn.bc.ca, click on the agriculture link, and you'll find our contact information there.
We hope that you enjoy this podcast series on growing opportunities in the RDBN.
The RDBN is providing this podcast as a public service. It is neither a legal interpretation nor a statement of government policies. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the RDBN. The views expressed by staff and guests are their own and do not represent the opinion of the RDBN or any of its directors. Presenters are not subject matter experts, and information presented should be verified by certified professionals prior to informing business or legal decisions.
Hi, I'm Megan Darcy, one of the agriculture coordinators working for the regional district of Bulkley Chaco. The focus of this podcast episode is forage. Forage in the agricultural context is essentially vegetation, grains, grasses, legumes, etc., that provide fiber, protein, and other essential dietary components for livestock. Forage production is a complex topic that includes perennial and annual crops, as well as native grasslands. In some cases, forage can mean shrubs and forbs consumed while animals are in forested areas. For the purpose of our discussion today, however, we will mostly be talking about perennial crops harvested and stored as either hay, silage, or more rarely, haylage. People are probably most familiar with hay, which has the lowest moisture content of the three when processed. Silage has the highest moisture content and is commonly stored in either a silage pit or in bales that are plastic wrapped to exclude oxygen. Haylage is also an ensiled feed, but has a lower moisture content than traditional silage. I have three guests on today's podcast. Well, four, if you count our alfalfa friend. All three have a ton of expertise in this topic, and I'm very grateful that they were able to come and share their knowledge and wisdom. I'm speaking with Nadia Mori, a professional agrologist who is currently contracting with the BC Climate Change Adaptation Program. Her work is focused on forage species adaptation in the Bulkley and Chaco and Fraser Fort George regional districts. Welcome, Nadia.
Hi, Megan. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the different forage species commonly grown in the regional district of Bulkley and Chaco.
Yes, producers are growing a wide variety of forages, depending on what they need and what times of management they would like to do on their land. Now, most forages grown in the area would be perennial, which means that they live for many years and would include plants like alfalfa, various clovers like your red clover, alsike clover, orchard grass and timothy are very common, but also smooth brome and meadow brome and tall fescue, just to name a few of the common perennial grasses. And then farmers and ranchers might also use annual forages in their rotation when they have different management goals.
Oh, that's really interesting. So you mentioned both legumes and grasses there. So what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of growing those very different forage species?
Legumes are really valued because they have high protein content that they're adding to the forage stand and also the forage that's being made out of it. And they also help fix nitrogen, given that they do have the proper inoculation. And so what that means is if you were to pull up a plant, a legume plant, so for example, alfalfa, you would see little nodules, little globules on the root and root hairs. And that is a symbiotic relationship between the plant and the nitrogen-fixing bacteria. And so if you were to cut open one of the nodules, you should see a light pinkish hue in there that would show that the nodule is actively fixing nitrogen out of the air, which is pretty amazing. And now you're thinking, okay, well, if legumes are so amazing, why don't we have just pure stands of legumes? Because a lot of the legumes do cause bloat, which can kill an animal, a ruminant animal. Some legumes don't, such as sainfoin birchwood trefoil and Sicer milkvetch, but they may have other challenges to grow. That's why we don't see them more often. And we also need some fiber in the diet for our livestock, and that's why we have grasses. And grasses also are usually much, much longer lived than the legumes are, and so that's why they still play a really important role in a forage stand.
Oh, that makes sense. So what are some important best management practices for growing forage in our area?
That's a really big, big question to ask. And I don't think I could quite do it justice in just a short answer, but I would say there's some key elements that somebody could look at. So first of all, it would be really important to look at proper soil health management. That can be done by managing your macro and micronutrients, looking at the pH balance and keeping that in check, and also making sure that the soil organic matter content of your soil is healthy and increasing, hopefully. Then the next thing would be to select forage species that are best adapted to the farm and the intended management. So, for example, if you're trying to have a blend that's intended for grazing on a pasture, it should look different than something that's for a high-producing hay stand. And then finally, managing the forage stand with the need of the plants in mind. Sometimes we might get a bit carried away by only focusing on the livestock needs, but we have to also think about the plants. For example, if we look at alfalfa, it actually has a critical harvest period, which is about 4 to 6 weeks before we anticipate the first frost in the fall. And in that time, it should actually not be cut or grazed, because during that time period, it has to put down root reserves and harden for winter dormancy. And if you end up cutting alfalfa or grazing it in that time, it forces it to put the reserves into regrowth rather than focusing on preparing for winter. And as a result, and if that's done a number of times in a row, your alfalfa might end up winter killing because it's not focused on hardening off, it's focused on trying to regrow. So that's just a little aspect there. But I would encourage, if somebody has more detailed questions about best management practices, to please talk to a forage agrologist as well.
Yeah, no, it's a very complex topic for sure. And there's a lot of variability as you move around the region, and also depending on, as you said, what people are managing their forage fields for in terms of, you know, what their priorities are. How do you feel that climate change is impacting forage production in our area?
What I've heard so far from producers is that everybody is definitely noticing changes. They're not all noticing the same changes, but I think that's an observation in itself, that there's a wide variability of changes. A common theme, though, is that moisture regime has changed. So, for example, maybe you've just seeded a new forage stand and the moisture is not coming. It's maybe coming too early, too late, or not at all. And then another common theme was the notice of extremes, and the extremes happening in a very, very short time period. So, for example, within the time span of a day, changing from minus 30 to zero in 24 hours, which can be really challenging for plants, livestock, and humans to adapt to.
Yeah, definitely. What are some ways that producers can manage these changes?
Now, that is a big question that has many, many aspects to it. And I think sometimes there are extremes that we just cannot really prepare for or manage for. For example, I was living in the Peace last summer, and we had this massive kind of plow wind type extreme wind event happening. And I stood at the window and I thought, you know, this is an extreme that I could not have prepared for as my greenhouse was blowing across the yard. But there are certain things that you can do, especially as a forage producer, by selecting the best species for the land that you have, the best adapted species, and then making sure that the forages have everything that they need, all the nutrition and all the pieces that can be managed by the manager, that they at least don't add additional stresses, or, you know, within reason, but that you're managing the pieces that are manageable. And then the rest, that's oftentimes out of our hands.
Right. Yeah, definitely. It's a little bit about expecting the unexpected. Would you mind talking a bit about the project that you're working on? And I understand that there's some upcoming workshops.
That's right. I'm currently working on a project funded through the BC Climate Change Adaptation Program, and it's delivered and administered through the BC Forage Council, the Eaglet Lake Farmers Institute, and the two regional districts of Bulkley Nechako and Fraser Fort George. And the goal of the project is to develop more resources specifically for the producers in the Bulkley Nechako and Fraser Fort George area on what forage species and varieties are best adapted for the area and best suitable to the region. And we will have some workshops to show kind of the results of the workshop and share some tools and teach some tools. The workshops are planned on April 28th in Prince George, April 29th in Vanderhoof, and April 30th in Smithers.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. And we'll definitely try to get the word out so that as many people as possible can come and learn from each other and learn from you and just in general be able to talk forage before the summer really hits in full force and everybody's out in the field.
That would be great. I'd love to see you out there.
So thank you very much, Nadia, for taking time to speak with me today.
You're most welcome.
In this week's episode of Untold Stories, we're exploring the life and times of an alfalfa plant growing in the Bulkley Nechako area. We know our listeners have seen this plant. Its lovely dark green leaves and purple flowers are easy to recognize. However, the alfalfa plant's story has yet to be told from its perspective. That's why we're here today. It's springtime, and the alfalfa plant awakens, having been dormant all winter.
Oh, hello, spring. Oh, this is my second year growing, and I feel so ready to fix some nitrogen, grow some more leaflets, and produce the most marvelous flowers later in the season. But first, you'll excuse me as I have to take a spring shower to wash off all that winter grime.
The snow is gone, and the field has dried out enough for farmers to start prepping the field for the upcoming growing season.
Ha! My landowner is pretty awesome. I got a good dose of phosphorus, potassium, and sulfur fertilizer when he got me started last year. You know, I saw him use one of these bulky rods in the soil. I think they call it a soil test that they did before seeding. Pretty smart. The one thing I don't need is nitrogen fertilizer because I can fix that all by myself right out of the atmosphere because I got some nitrogen factories downstairs in my root system because I was properly inoculated and I just got those nodules pumping nitrogen away. This year, I heard the land manager is also making sure I'm getting some micronutrients. Yummy! Now, did you know every time a ton of alfalfa hay is harvested, it takes out about 58 pounds of nitrogen, 14 pounds of phosphorus, 60 pounds of potassium, and 6 pounds of sulfur. That's a lot. I mean, I don't know numbers, but that sure sounds like a lot.
After a successful season of growing, the alfalfa plant is now ready for harvest.
You know, sometimes in July, usually when I'm just about to open my beautiful first flowers, this nice farmer comes along and gives me a haircut. I guess it's okay, but it also means I have to regrow again, which, you know, it's not really a problem, as long as I have enough water to drink.
In addition to being an important component of stored forage, alfalfa can be a good pasture plant as well.
I'm telling you, sometimes those four-legged critters come along at the end of August. I don't mind them, actually. They leave behind those lovely little fertilizer patties. Maybe that's a thank you for us plants. I should really ask them about that.
Eventually, the alfalfa plant reaches old age after several years and goes to sleep in the winter and then releases the nitrogen for the next generation.
After those critters leave me, I really have to hurry up and get ready for winter. I'm telling you, winter is no joke up here. It can get seriously cold, but the best part is when it snows because it's like a nice blanket that keeps me warm all winter until springtime comes again. And in a few years' time, I will have lived out a pretty eventful life with lots of haircuts and lots of nibbles. And then one winter will come and I think I'll just go to sleep and be asleep forever. But that's okay because I'll make room for some new amazing plants. I just don't like it when new alfalfa plants move right in where I used to grow. I mean, they can just wait a little bit. So I've done a nifty trick where I put out a natural chemical into the soil that prevents other alfalfa plants from coming in my old space. Pretty nifty. It usually takes about a year to break down before the next generation of rowdy alfalfa plants can move in. But hey, still, stop by and just see how I'm doing, okay?
To our loyal listeners and those just tuning in, this is a work of fiction. No actual alfalfa plants were harmed in the making of this skit.
I'm speaking with Wayne Ray, a rancher and forage producer from the south of Fort Fraser. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So we're here to talk about forage today. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your operation.
Well, we have about 2,500 acres of land, although we only produce crops or alfalfa mainly off of about 850 to 950 acres, depending on the year. We grow mostly alfalfa or alfalfa grass mixes, and we bale it mainly into round bales for sale.
Do you have cattle?
We used to have a couple hundred head of cattle, but we haven't had cattle since 2018.
So do you mostly sell your forage within the region, or do you go outside the region?
Almost all of our hay this year went to Williams Lake area, as far as south as Empire Valley Ranch, which is south of Gang Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly either east or west of Williams Lake.
Do you find it tricky to grow that much alfalfa?
Well, it's something that we have to try to be able to have the right conditions to bale it without getting any rain on it. Last year, I think we put up a little over 2,000 bales, and we only had about 15 bales that had any rain at all.
What characteristics do you look for when you look at your forage stands and sort of determine how well they're doing?
Well, I like to see a real heavy stand, and I like to see the alfalfa growing usually about 3 feet high before I cut it, and cut it at the pre-bloom stage. We plant several different varieties. We have some fields that have a single variety, but not very many. Most of our fields have between 5 and 7 or 8 different varieties of alfalfa, like taproot varieties, open crown varieties, spreader type varieties that may survive different weather events or may handle the elk pawing better. Some varieties work better than others. And I just worked up a field a couple of years ago that had been in production for 19 years. It was seeded with a six-way mix of varieties. Mm-hmm. And there were still three varieties that were still doing really well.
Just in general, like, what do you find are some of the bigger challenges?
Well, the climate has definitely changed in the last 20 years. It's been a lot wetter in the fall and drier in the spring. Overall, summer temperatures have been lower and winter temperatures have been higher. And we've had less snowfall than we had for the previous 30 years. Another big issue we've had in recent years is elk pawing in the fields and causing the alfalfa to die. When there's 8 inches of snow to about 2 feet of snow, and they just paw the crap out of it, and then it causes it to die because they shear it off right at the surface.
So do you have any pearls of wisdom for people who are learning about growing forage or even experienced people?
Well, one thing I discovered is try to do your own on-farm forage testing, because there's such a variety of climate. There's little microclimates that are twice as much rainfall and twice as much frost-free days and different soil conditions all over the place. So you pretty well have to do field scale tests on your own land. Like I did a couple of projects where I planted 1/2 mile long strips that were probably 10 acres each, and then planted different rates of seed and also different varieties of seed and then mixtures of seed to see what survived the best and what produced the best. Sometimes you can do that and just look at it and you'll think one is doing way better than the other, but if you clip it and weigh it, take a bunch of samples, random samples, and you'll learn that what it looks like may not necessarily be what it's producing. Even on our own land, we sit on the southwest corner of the old Nechaco Lake, where we've got 500 feet of silty clay loam and no rock, but we have probably two or three distinct varieties of clay, and each one of them grows differently. And if you've got sandy loam soil, it's usually too acidic to have long-term alfalfa stands. We've learned to try to plant more grass on the sandy loam areas and plant alfalfa on the clay areas.
Oh, cool. And
if the land is too flat, alfalfa can get flooded out in winter kill.
Right.
So we like to plant alfalfa where it's more rolling or south-facing slopes.
Huh, that's really interesting. Have you experimented with other legumes at all?
Nothing other than different kinds of clovers, but clovers are even harder to dry than alfalfa. Alfalfa will keep growing for anywhere from 10 to 20 years at least 2 or 2.5 tons to the acre, where other things like clover seem to die out rather quickly.
Do they self-seed at all?
You probably could get them to self-seed if you let them grow until they were way over mature and set their seed and drop the seed. Orchard grass does that in our area. If you don't get on it early enough, it'll mature and self-seed itself.
Oh, okay. What other grass species do you usually have coming in?
One time we had good luck with using a type of meadow brome that would grow 7 feet high, but the brome kind of died out. We've used lots of varieties of timothy, tall fescue, orchard grass, brome, and just the older varieties of plants seem to do better than the newer varieties. Some of the new varieties will do really well as far as production goes for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then it really falls off, where some of the older varieties are more tolerant to our changing conditions. Some of the newer varieties, I think the seed growers are growing them because of the amount of pounds of seed they produce per acre, not the amount of forage they produce and not the longevity.
Yeah, for sure. How often do you normally rejuvenate your crop fields?
We try to go for at least 12 or 15 years, then the production will drop. Like in the beginning, sometimes you'll get between 4 and 6 tons per acre in the beginning for about the first 7 or 8 years, and then it slowly tapers off. Then usually between 12 and 15 years, it'll drop off to less than 2 tons to the acre. So it's not really worth doing.
And then after 12 or 15 years, you just turn it over and start again?
We turn it over and start again. But it's expensive when you turn the land over, and it helps build the topsoil better if you can make alfalfa stay there for a long time, because it puts roots down sometimes 20 or 30 feet into the ground. And some of those roots are the size of your arm by the time we work it up.
Well, do you harvest it before it flowers?
We start harvesting before it flowers, but sometimes it's full bloom. And if we get really bad weather during the haying season, then some fields, some years don't get cut till the end of August. And then the bloom is pretty well all gone off some varieties, and seeds are already formed. Alfalfa grows lots of leaves and fine stems until it blooms. And once it blooms, then the stems start getting coarser, and it doesn't grow more leaves. It just grows more stem. It'll grow 3 feet high, and then it'll fall down, and then it'll grow up about another 30 inches. And sometimes it'll be 7 feet tall, but it's laying on the ground. And when you cut it, it goes through the conditioner rollers before it gets cut off, and it'll suck 100 horsepower out of a tractor really quick.
Yeah.
And then makes it really difficult to dry when the stems are big. So we try to cut it with a disc type mower conditioner and crush all the stems so it dries quicker, and hope that we can get it done without getting rained on.
Oh, that's a good idea. So you don't harvest it, sorry, the way you would harvest a typical hayfield necessarily.
No, alfalfa is trickier to get cured properly. The stems are so big on it, if it gets over mature, then it's really difficult to dry.
No, I could see that, especially if the weather is cooler.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Well, Wayne, thank you very much for chatting with me today.
Okay.
So my next podcast guest is Paul Davidson. He co-owns Canyon Creek Farm with his brother, Near Smithers. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Megan. Yes, thank you for having me on the Forage podcast.
Yeah, we're delighted. So I wanted to first ask you a little bit about your operation. Do you mind just kind of giving us a description of what you've got going on there?
Okay. We farm just outside of Smithers. It's a dairy and beef farm. We milk about 65 milking cows and 60 cow-calf beef operation. Our farm is about 1,000 acres of owned land, and we rent from nearby neighbors a little bit of hayland and pasture. We mostly grow our forage to be harvested as silage. So in terms of our hay crop, we want to try and get as big a yield as we can get in our area without giving up too much protein. Like if we let the crop get too over mature, we'll lose on protein that we need for our milking cows to milk well. But if we don't get enough production, we might not have enough feed to feed our beef cows.
Does the silage give you any advantage with respect to the protein?
Yeah, I would say it does, because what we try to do with our hay fields is grow alfalfa as our legume in the crop and Rome grass as our main grass ingredient. And our thinking is that the alfalfa is providing the protein and the Rome grass is providing the volume. And what we can do with the silaging is that if you're not familiar with silage process, you cut the grass into little bits and it blows into a wagon, and we dump the wagon into a truck, and then we take it into the farm and dump it in a pit. But by doing this process, we're taking the entire field or fields and putting them in this layered into this silo. So you really average out your over mature corners of your field and your heavy alfalfa parts of your field. So you get a real balanced crop that the cows get kind of every day, because they're getting a little slice of several fields that you've harvested in that silo. If that makes sense.
It does. And the silo is quite big, right?
Oh, each of our silos hold about 350 bigger dump truck loads of silage in two different pits. So it's a lot of volume.
Right. Do you find it goes anaerobic in the middle? Or I guess, is it supposed to be anaerobic?
Yeah, this green feed goes in every day of our harvest cycle. We're bringing in fresh green feed. And then you want the silage to warm. It warms up to about, you want to be around 115, 120 degrees at the top end, but you don't want it colder than 80. This is Fahrenheit temperatures, but you don't want it any colder than 80. So you let it warm up and then you pack the air out of it. So in the 2 weeks that we're doing our silage, we're packing the silo every night and the next morning to push the air out of the green feed. And then that will then ferment. And when we're done, we've got our silo full, we'll pack it really tight one more time, and then we'll cover it with plastic to keep the oxygen out. You have a little bit of waste on the top where it kind of has a rot layer, which seals it in underneath the plastic.
It sounds pretty intensive.
Yeah. So you get a little bit of losses with your spoilage, but you get a lot more, like when you're baling hay, you're losing a little bit of nice fines on your hay falls out of your baler. Whereas when you're doing silage, you're getting all of the crop basically into your silo.
Including all the fines.
We plan to get only one cut a year. And if we get a second cut on some of the first stuff we do, we've considered a good year. And we have the ability to irrigate just a little bit of our close by fields to the main farm. But most of our fields, we figure we'll get one cutting and then we'll graze the cows on it late in the fall.
Oh yeah, I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, the trick to that though is what we used to say is you can cut your first crop of pusey about the end of June, early July. If you get if you get timely rain, you might get a second cut in early August. But Dad's strategy always was you should never cut your alfalfa fields after about August 10th to maybe August 15th, because you need to give the alfalfa time to rest up and build its reserves before winter. So we wouldn't,
that makes sense.
Yeah, so we would let that grow. So if we get a second cut before that time, that's great. And if we don't, then we'll just let it grow. And then we'll put the cattle out, most usually the beef cows, out on the hay fields after we've had a first frost or two. So the alfalfa plants have shut down, and then we'll graze it off without going too short. But that's the plan anyway.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when you're assessing your forage fields, are there certain characteristics that you're looking for, or how do you assess your forage fields to know about whether or not they're successful?
So the trick to a lot of our fields is we like the alfalfa, but there's only alfalfa doesn't do really well in low areas. One thing is we decide which areas are best for our alfalfa crops, and then we'll try to keep at least a 50% alfalfa to brome. We'd like to start out higher than that when we get our initial seeding done, and then we hope that initial seeding will last us 6 to 8 years, we hope. And then, but what we watch for is if you have freeze out spots in these lows areas, or we've had icing in the winter that'll kill the alfalfa, then we might have to rework or overseed that field, improve the amount of legume in there.
Right.
So it's an ongoing process of how much legume have we got that it would be enough that we'll get a high protein enough crop for our dairy cows.
Right.
We don't worry too much about the fields we use for our beef cows because they can get by on grassier crops. So we try to keep our best fields for our dairy cows as far as the legume to grass percentage.
So you were saying earlier that you do make some hay.
Yes.
So is it mostly on the grass fields then that you focus the hay crop?
The advantage of the silage is that we can cut our silage crops even if it's a bit rainy weather.
Right.
So what we'll often do is cut the outside of our hay fields, which is usually the heavier crop tends to be on the outside of your field. Hmm. So then we'll leave the lighter stuff in the center, grassier areas, for making hay later on. So then it's a lot easier to rake your hay field and if the weather's not that great for making hay later on.
What are some of the bigger challenges that you feel like you have with respect to growing forage and both the alfalfa crops and the alfalfa grass crops?
So with the alfalfa, like I said already, the icing and freezing is a major concern. Overgrazing is a bit of an issue with alfalfa because the deer and the cattle like to eat the young alfalfa if they get out there. So it's a matter of timing when animals are on those fields. So yeah, we do use a little bit of alfalfa in our pasture as well. We tend to use more orchard grass on our pastures because it grows back so well after it's been grazed.
Right.
So we've been experimenting a bit, mixing alfalfa in those newer pastures with orchard grass for our dairy cows to graze, and that's been quite successful. But the risk to that is you could risk having a dairy cow bloat if you have too much alfalfa in there. So we would tend to electric fence how much pasture they get to avoid that problem.
Do you time it like with respect to where the alfalfa is at? Like there seems to be a certain window there that if you feed alfalfa, it's more likely to bloat.
So what we try to do, like say we electric fence it, or we'll feed hay before they go out, or so they're not quite so hungry when they get into it. And
then
we'll really try to avoid letting them on any grass that's too fresh. And the other thing is, it's even worse if you've had a frost and you put your cattle out. So you should never put your cattle out on a frosty morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I kind of knew about like the plant sugars being higher.
Yes.
Like in the morning.
Yeah.
As well. Like, whereas if you can wait till the dew's off, I found when I read up on it for the sheep, I kind of remember that, that you basically wait till the dew is burned off because by then, the sugars in the plant have gone down.
Exactly. Yeah.
And have you had any other things that have cropped up lately as challenges? I know the weather has been a little bit on the challenging side.
Yeah, dry years. I'll tell you a problem that we've got, and it's kind of been getting worse because of the dry years, is that, maybe 20 years ago, we tried a little bit of a grass called meadow foxtail. And are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah.
It looks like Timothy, but it isn't. it gets mature really early. Right. And it's really not a very palatable grass, like especially the dairy cows, they really don't like it. So they'll sort it out and they'll leave it behind. But the problem with this grass is that we found is it will get mature like in June, middle of June. It's got seed heads. And by the time you go to harvest it, this light fluffy seed gets all over your equipment. And it's really easy to spread this meadow foxtail all over your fields. And what we found is in certain parts of our bigger hay fields, we've got a lot of this meadow foxtail just voluntarily seeded. And now it makes up a big part of our hay field. But if you don't harvest it soon enough, it's really an overmature, non-palatable crop. So it's kind of forcing us to harvest those fields earlier than we really want to, because the other grasses in those fields are alfalfa and brome are more designed to be a later harvesting thing. But this meadow foxtail is such a big proponent now of that field that we feel like we have to harvest it to control it from spreading and also to get a better quality crop of what we got. So I blame that kind of on the drier conditions. And then certain weeds can be a real problem, of course, but something like thistles, if you can cut them soon enough, then you can avoid the seed, right? So that's another advantage of silage. When you cut a weedy thing like a thistle, it actually is ferments with the rest of the crop and actually is much more palatable to the cows. And the seeds often aren't viable if they've been kind of heated to that degree. So it helps in weed control to making silage to some extent. And certainly stuff like hawkweed has been a major problem for, I think, lots of farmers in the valley. And it's a problem for us certainly in a lot of our pastures, because we just can't graze off the hawkweed fast enough when it's flowering to control its seed production. So we've had some real damage to hawkweed in some of our pastures. So I'm still not sure what the real answer is to deal with that, but we've found if we lay on the manure, it helps a bit, but it certainly doesn't get rid of it by any means. And I think we're going to have to overseed those crops or something.
So I just wanted to finish up by asking you if you have any pearls of wisdom for people who are learning about growing forage, or even some of the more experienced people out there.
Well, you know, one thing we've done, and it came from it was probably a Ministry of Ag field day many, many years ago. It might have been through Glendale Agri at the time, but they were promoting fall fertilizing. And it's something we started to do on a fairly regular basis. And the main reasons we liked fall fertilizing is that the idea is you wait till the crops have pretty much shut down for the winter, and then you spread your fertilizer, this is commercial fertilizers, just in like probably October, but you want to do it just before it's going to snow. So the idea being you're spreading the fertilizer when there's moisture to take it into the ground before the ground is frozen. The advantage is you're doing it when you know you have moisture, as opposed to in the spring spreading fertilizer when you hope you're going to get moisture. The fields are a lot firmer in the fall, so you're not doing the damage with your tractor and equipment that you might do in the spring if you have wet fields. We have quite a bit of clay on some of our field areas, so we found we were getting a lot of compaction in the spring. So we found if we do the fall fertilizing, it's one less job to do in the spring. And in some years, there was some really good results.
Well, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your expertise, Paul.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks again to my guests, Nadia Mori, Wayne Ray, and Paul Davidson for speaking with me today. This episode was hosted by me, Megan Darcy, and edited by Pamela Hawson. Our liability waiver was read by Jason Llewellyn, and artwork is by Michelle Roberge. The music for Growing Opportunities podcast is found on the Free Music Archive.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Growing Opportunities podcast series. This and other Growing Opportunities podcasts can be accessed through all the major podcast apps and on the RDBN and CICK websites. The link to the RDBN website is rdbn.bc.ca. Have a great day and keep growing.